Hello, this is Susan Cecil, and I love KBOO. Do you love KBOO? Call us at 503-231-8032, extension 302, and tell us why you love KBOO. We'll use the audio during our upcoming spring membership drive. It takes the community to support the community radio station, KBOO! Yay! The number again, 503-231-8032, extension 302. This has been Susan Cecil for KBOO Portland, signing out. Bye!
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, today, if the telephone leprechauns work correctly, I hope to be speaking to Lucas Kerner, one of the editors of Venezuela Analysis, live from Caracas, Venezuela, and we are working on that as I speak. Fearless engineer Clementine is trying to dial through the chaos in Caracas, and so I want to start with a couple of headline news items. Of course, the reason I want to bring up Venezuela is because the U.S. is trying to eat Venezuela, and that is what I've titled this program, Eating Venezuela. You can find the link to this program on kboo.fm, and after we're done at 10 a.m., maybe about 15, 20 minutes after that, you'll be able to get this as a podcast. But I want to talk to someone who is directly experiencing what's going on, and Venezuela Analysis has been a very good site. Before I get started with that, though, there seems to be some other warmongering going on. Keeping in mind the sort of persons who have been brought on board with the Trump administration, which, like a lot of administrations, talked peace at first and now seems to be preparing for war. The situation in North Korea is getting worse because it would appear that the CIA attacked the North Korean embassy in Madrid. According to the BBC, on 22nd February, a group of 10 assailants reportedly broke into the building, tying up, beating, and interrogating 8 people inside the North Korean embassy there. The incident took place in Madrid just days before a key summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And now there are reports U.S. intelligence services were involved, with the U.S. and North Korea striving to improve relations after 70 years of hostility. Such allegations could be explosive. And they go on saying that the BBC contacted the cops in Madrid. And local media reports, again, that on the afternoon of 22nd of February, a group of 10 people broke into North Korea's embassy just before the summit. According to El Confidencial, the assailants gagged and tied up staff members and took a number of computers. One woman managed to get free, escaping through a second-floor woman and screaming for help. Concerned neighbors quickly called police. So this is a CIA-type provocation. And what it means with Bolton, John Bolton in office, and conducting U.S. warfare issues. It means that they're not being sincere at all, and the observers of the negotiations with the North Koreans observed that indeed they are not being sincere, because they are saying that they want the North Koreans to get rid of everything at once and that they won't accept incremental change. Stefan Biegun told a Washington audience, "We are not going to do denuclearization incrementally." That's printed on Vox. That's the top U.S. diplomat tasked with negotiating with North Korea just laid out a denuclearization plan that's destined to fail. They write, in his first public comment since President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un met in Vietnam last month, Stephen Biegun, the U.S. Special Representative for North Korea, told a Washington audience Monday that the administration wants Pyongyang to give up all of its weapons of mass destruction before anything else. And he said the foundation of U.S. policy is denuclearization. But then he said, we're not going to do denuclearization incrementally. Now, speaking for myself, that's how denuclearization is done, and that's what has kept you from being incinerated by Russian bombs decades ago, or your parents, however that works out. But it's not just nuclear weapons. They write, the Trump administration also wants the complete removal of chemical and biological weapons from North Korea, meaning the U.S. wants Pyongyang only to have conventional weapons by the end of the process. Now, again, speaking for myself, of course, Pyongyang's not going to do that because they went for biological and chemical and laser, blinding laser weapons, and then nuclear weapons, because they knew that they did not have the money or the resources to compete with the U.S. warfare machine located to the south. So this is, they write it up as it is a strategy destined to fail. I would add that it is a strategy intended to fail. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, and as I was saying, we are trying to get in contact with Lucas Kerner, who is in Caracas, and the power has been on and off in Caracas, and so we're just hoping that we can get through to him and actually speak. But I want to add that there is an anti-war group, a coalition in Portland called Hands Off Venezuela, and they have an education and action, including Dan Shi, report back coming up. And that's going to be Saturday from 3 to 5 in the Fellowship Hall in the First Congregational UCC, at which is a church, at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue downtown, at the Park Blocks. So that's Saturday 3 to 5, 2 days from now, and a report back from someone who has, I think, been in Venezuela. And I'll just look over into the engineering room, and I don't think we have our guest quite yet. We're working on that. And so I will give you some more information about what's going on in Venezuela. As I've been saying over the past weeks, what has been reported in U.S. press has nothing to do with the truth. We have heard that, even from the New York Times, that their previous reporting claiming that the famous burning trucks were set on fire by Maduro's men was a lie, was propaganda. It was, in fact, set on fire by Guaido's men, supposedly by accident. And the video that you can see shows someone tossing a Molotov without affixing the flaming top properly. What is it with people in Molotovs? I don't know when the last time I saw a Molotov thrown correctly. Maybe it's time to just give up on those things. But anyway, the fire of the Molotov did not go where the bottle was thrown. It went onto the truck and caught it on fire. And that was not Maduro's people at all. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even within the group of Maduro's people at the time that that happened. So here's some more information. Portland folks, are you ready to show up to stop the U.S. from attempting a coup in Venezuela? Your local Code Pink friends are joining with Hands Off Venezuela PDX and the Portland chapter of Veterans for Peace to learn more about U.S. intervention in Venezuela and take to the streets to say Hands Off Venezuela. First, we'll hear from Dan Shi, who has just returned from Venezuela, where he's on a delegation with the U.S. Peace Council. Then we'll march to the Hawthorne Bridge for a banner drop. Let's show our solidarity with the National March on Washington, D.C., happening the same day, to say Hands Off Venezuela. And Code Pink says, make sure you wear pink. That is, again, at the Fellowship Hall and First Congregational United Church of Christ at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland, just FYI. Now, Max Blumenthal wrote in the Gray Zone, thegrayzone.com, earlier this week, the U.S.-funded Canvas organization that trained Juan Guaido and his allies produced a 2010 memo on exploiting electricity outages and urged the opposition to take advantage of the situation towards their needs. And I've gotten a request to take a 1 minute break. It has to do with some logistical efforts here. So let's go ahead and take that 1 minute break, and I'll be right back. are back. And as I was saying, we were trying to get through to Caracas and having a little difficulty with that because the power has been off and on. Power has been off and on because the U.S. Has infected the control system of the main hydroelectric plant there with a Stuxnet type virus. And I'll have more on that in a minute. I was saying earlier that a September 2010 memo, this is like more than 8 years ago, by a U.S.-funded soft power organization that helped train Venezuelan coup leader Juan Guaido and his allies, identifies the potential collapse of the country's electrical sector as a watershed event that would likely have the impact, this is a quote now, of galvanizing public unrest in a way that no opposition group could ever hope to generate, end quote. And so before I move on that article, I want to reflect on that for a moment. So this is 8 years ago. This is in the U.S., actually, I don't know if it's in the U.S., but it's a U.S.-funded soft power organization. In other words, a conspiracy group trained Juan Guaido and identified in their own papers in a 2010 memo that one way they could create public unrest, in other words, one way they could destabilize Venezuela or any country, is to cut the electrical power. And their phrase is galvanizing public unrest in a way that no opposition group could ever hope to generate. So if you had any hopes that the failure of the electrical power in Venezuela was a coincidence, I would say that that's a pretty thin hope, especially with Marco Rubio gleefully gloating over the loss of power and somehow knowing that the backup generators were not functioning before that news was even reported. So returning to that information, the memo has special relevance today as Guaido moves to exploit nationwide blackouts caused by a major failure at the Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant at the Guri Dam, a crisis that Venezuela's government blames on U.S. sabotage. It was authored by Sergio Popovich of the Center of Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, a Belgrade-based democracy promotion organization, that's in quotes there, democracy promotion, funded by the U.S. government that has trained thousands of U.S.-aligned youth activists in countries where the West seeks regime change. Now, this is, speaking for myself, this is one of many such groups which basically promotes U.S. power. It's called soft power because they don't start right away shooting you down or setting off the bombs, but that's what it leads to eventually. They very much prefer, as you might have heard on Democracy Now!, very much prefer that the people within the country kill each other rather than the U.S. Commit troops and spend that money and spend that prestige. Generally speaking, I don't know in the case of Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, or CANVAS, but it's probably funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. That's how they that's how they helped collapse Russia, for example, put the drunk Boris Yeltsin in power, who bombed his own parliament with artillery. And basically, they gave him so much money that he could just hand out $50,000 to whoever he wanted to give power in the area. And that was a hell of a amount of, that was a hell of a lot of power at a time when everyone was broke. Can you imagine having $50,000 in 1990 dollars when nobody's got a dime? And the oppressive regime that now exists in Russia has recovered from that crisis in which not only did the Soviet Union collapse, but the major industries, everything from the power plants to the manufacturing plants, were sold off even though they weren't for sale. And the most greedy and bloodthirsty people were put in power by the National Endowment for Democracy. Paul Weyrich's group, he was very proud of that. Returning to the information from The Gray Zone by Max Blumenthal, this group reportedly hosted Guaido and the key leaders of his popular Will Party for a series of training sessions, fashioning them into Generation 2007, determined to foment resistance to then President Hugo Chavez and sabotage his plans to implement 21st century socialism in Venezuela. In the 2010 memo, CANVAS's Popovich declared, quote, "A key to Chavez's current weakness is the decline in the electricity sector. End quote. Popovich explicitly identified the Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant as a friction point, emphasizing that water levels at the Gurri Dam are dropping, this is a quote, and Chávez has been unable to reduce consumption sufficiently to compensate for the deteriorating industry, end quote. Speculating on a grave possibility that some 70% of the country's electricity grid could go dark as soon as April 2010, which is just nonsense that they are speculating on, the Canvas leader stated that, quote, an opposition group would be best served to take advantage of the situation and spin it against Chávez and towards their needs. Flash forward to March 2019, the scenario outlined by Popovich is playing out almost exactly as he had imagined. On March 7th, just days after Guaido's return from Colombia, where he participated in the failed and demonstrably violent February 23rd attempt to ram a shipment of U.S. aid across the Venezuelan border, the Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant experienced a major and still unexplained collapse. And he writes, still unexplained, but the Venezuelan government has determined that it was, in fact, a Stuxnet-type virus, and they are gathering information to present to the United Nations to charge the United States with this crime, a war crime. Days later, he writes, electricity remains sporadic across the country. Meanwhile, Guaido has done everything he can to take advantage of the situation and spin it against President Nicolás Maduro, just as his allies were urged to do over 8 years ago by Canvas. The Venezuelan government has placed the blame squarely on Washington, accusing it of sabotage through a cyber attack on its electrical infrastructure. Key players in the U.S.-directed coup attempt have done little to dispel the accusation. Now, again, speaking for myself, the way the Stuxnet virus works is, well, in the case of Iran, where it first appeared, it was used to attack the centrifuges, which were isolating isotopes of uranium for use in nuclear power and medicine, said the Iranians, for bombs, said the Israelis in the U.S. And it was introduced, they think, by an infected piece of equipment, probably a thumb drive, because the Iranians, knowing that the Israelis constantly attack everything that they have, their space program, everything, had tried to isolate it as best they can from the web. Now, in Venezuela, I would guess that the Gurri hydroelectric plant probably wasn't as carefully isolated, and they probably didn't even have to bother to insert an infected thumb drive, although I suppose that would be easy enough. In any event, the failures there bear the mark of Stuxnet, which basically uses the distributed, there's a name for this which I'm forgetting, the distributed command structure through the computers to tell various pieces of equipment to operate at too high a speed or too low a speed or too low a voltage or whatever until they shred themselves. I just got a look from the engineer, which I think I can interpret as can't get through to Venezuela. So that may be the case. It may be the case that we are not going to be able to get through to Venezuela, but we're going to keep trying every 5-10 minutes or so and see if we can get through. Because you never know when power is going to go back on under conditions like that. So in the meantime, you are invited to call in. The number to call with your comments and questions about U.S. war with, let's face it, it's not just Venezuela. It's North Korea, Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, all the little countries that Trump's people, Bolton, that Trump thinks they can eat easily. I would say that's on the move. That's on rails. And it's up to us to stop it. And it is extremely dangerous, not just because it's war, but because Trump needs the legitimacy and the automatic, the knee-jerk response that Americans always undertake, that they always transform into. Trump needs that American military butt-kissing response. And I know that there are people listening to me right now who will make a snappy salute and send their kids off to die. And I wish you weren't like that, because if you knew the truth, you wouldn't. But most of you, you're a KBOO audience, kind of self-selecting, and you're anti-war. And so I would like to ask you to, of course, anyone, call in 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. 8187. As I mentioned before, and I will mention specifically in a few minutes again, there are actions coming up in Portland to protest and prevent war with Venezuela, which I believe will take initially the form of a contra war. And I'll get around to reasons why I think that is probably the way it's going to happen. I've gotten more details since last week when I was talking about that. Number to call again, 503-231-8187. The Venezuelan government is under attack, and at noon on March 7th, during a hearing on Venezuela at the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee, Senator Marco Rubio explicitly called for the U.S. to stir widespread unrest, declaring that it needs to happen, that's a quote, needs to happen, in order to achieve regime change. The quote from Marco Rubio is, "Venezuela is going to enter a period of suffering no nation in our hemisphere has confronted in modern history," end quote. And speaking for myself, it's pretty clear to me that Marco Rubio thinks that's just great, that he can make an innocent population, quote, "enter a period of suffering no nation in our hemisphere has confronted in modern history," end quote. And I wonder what would please Rubio the best. Would Marco Rubio like to see children die of cholera, like in Yemen? Would he? Would Marco Rubio get his jollies by seeing people shot to rags in the streets by Contras? Would Marco Rubio like to see death squads, like his buddies in El Salvador used to do? I wonder what would really make Marco Rubio happy. But I'm going to take the first caller, number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and Jack's on the air.
Hi. Dan Shea has been reporting regularly on his trip to Venezuela through his Facebook feed. And I would say that anybody who wants to get up to date with that, just go there and become friends with Dan, and he'll probably accept you right away, and then and you could get all updated with in that way if you wanted to.
All right. Mm-hmm. That's Dan Shea, S-H-E-A?
Correct, correct. I think that's the way he pronounces it. I'm not certain on that, but anyway, he's with he's one of the leaders in Portland Veterans Against Veterans for Peace, I believe it is, and he did a little GoFundMe thing to get down there and got enough support to do it, and he's been sending regular reports several times a day with photos and captions, etc., from that International Peace Conference.
And since you brought it up, he will be speaking at Fellowship Hall and First Congregational United, I can't remember what the mm-hmm. OCC stand for, at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue, Saturday from 3 to 5. So it's
right,
downtown.
Right. And what I was saying is that if anybody wants to get up to speed right now, they just couldn't quickly, easily online do it.
All right, then.
Thank you.
Thank you. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. At 5:18 p.m., 18 minutes after the electrical plant went down on March 7th, I think it was, a clearly excited Rubio took to Twitter to announce the blackout and to claim that backup generators have failed. It is unclear how Rubio obtained such specific information so soon after the outage occurred. According to Jorge Rodriguez, the communication minister of Venezuela, local authorities did not know if backup generators had failed at the time of Rubio's tweet. Back in Caracas, Guaido immediately set out to exploit the situation, just as his canvas trainers had advised over 8 years before. Taking Twitter just an hour before Rubio, Guaido declared, quote, "the light will return when the usurpation," meaning Maduro, "ends," end quote. Like Pompeo, the self-declared president framed the blackouts as part of a regime change strategy, not an accident or error. 2 days later, Guaido was at the center of an opposition rally he convened in affluent eastern Caracas. That's the pattern, by the way, and the people that he can count on to support him are the rich. Bellowing into a megaphone, quote, "Article 187, when the time comes, we need to be in the streets mobilized. It depends on us, not on anybody else," end quote. And Article 187 establishes the right of the National Assembly to authorize the use of Venezuelan military missions abroad or foreign in the country, but that's in the case of an emergency. Upon his mention of the constitutional article, Guaido's supporters responded, "Intervention, intervention." And the article goes on to talk more about Canvas, a spinoff of Otpor, a Serbian protest group founded by Serge Popovic. And it does mention that Canvas, here we are, is funded largely through the National Endowment for Democracy. A CIA cutout that functions as the U.S. government's main arm promoting regime change. Skipping forward, a leaked email from a Stratfor staffer, that's the CIA-linked allegedly private group, noted that after they ousted Milosevic, the kids who ran Otpor grew up, got suits, and designed Canvas, or in other words, Export Revolution Group, that sowed the seeds for a number of color revolutions. They are still hooked on to U.S. funding and basically go around the world trying to topple dictators and autocratic governments, ones that the U.S. does not like. Stratfor subsequently revealed that Canvas turned its attention to Venezuela in 2005 after training opposition movements that led pro-NATO regime change operations across Eastern Europe. That's you probably want to be thinking about Ukraine in that case. In September 2010, as Venezuela headed for parliamentary election, Canvas produced a series of memos outlining the plans they had hatched with non-formal actors like Guaido and his cadre of student activists to bring down Chavez. This is the first opportunity for the opposition to get back into a position of power, Popovic wrote at the time. In his memo on electricity outages, Popovic highlighted the importance of the Venezuelan military in achieving regime change. Quote, alliances with the military could be critical because in such a situation of massive public unrest and rejection of the presidency, malcontent sectors of the military will likely decide to intervene, but only if they believe they have sufficient support, end quote. And so that's part of that strategy I was talking about of having people of Venezuela kill each other rather than having U.S. troops go down there and do most of the work. I've been talking about a push towards war generally in the U.S. from the Trump administration, being pumped by the Trump administration, and being pumped by John Bolton and Elliot Abrams, the war criminal who was involved in President Reagan's and President Bush's Central America massacres, and who is now in charge of the situation there in Venezuela. And number to call, 503-231-8187. It's 928. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and go to the first caller.
Hey, Teresa, how are you?
Hi, doing well.
Good. This is from The Nation magazine, February 25th to March 4th, and it's 2019. All right, according to this article, Little Marco Rubio, is acting as a shadow Secretary of State for Latin America. There's also a fellow involved called Mauricio Gravacalón. He's a Cuban-American lobbyist, special assistant to number 45, and he is also the senior director at the National Security Council for Western Hemisphere. All right, and you have already mentioned Elliot Abrams. As you know, Elliot Abrams was convicted of a war crime under Reagan. He was pardoned by H.W. Bush, and along with Caspar Weinberger, and you will never guess who H.W. Bush's attorney general was. That would be Mr. Barr, who's the attorney general for number 45 now.
Oh, well, the old gang is back then.
The old gang is back. Teresa, it seems that what they do is trot out all the old pigs, slap a little lipstick on them, and make them a little presentable to us, and present them to us all over again. Anyway, if this article is really, really worth reading. The Nation magazine, February 24th, March 5th, 2019. And I do believe you can get the Nation, did this article online, thenation.com.
All right.
Have a really nice day. We really appreciate what you do.
Thanks. Thanks for calling in. Bye. All right. And we will try at least one more time to get through to Venezuela. But as I was saying, we've had no luck so far. It seems that the exchanges will allow the call to only go so far through. So I'm continuing with information and your calls about Venezuela and about what's actually happening there, trying to put things in the frame of reality as opposed to the propaganda frame that has taken the U.S. population and certainly the U.S. media by storm, so to speak. Now, I used the machine to translate La Jornada and their article on yesterday's article on the situation in Venezuela, and they say that Rick Perry, the Secretary of Energy of the United States, and if I remember correctly, a former governor of Texas, declared that in Venezuela, the American oil companies want to see the end of the regime of Nicolas Maduro, quote, so that we can return again, end quote. And when he said we, he meant oil companies. In an interview with CNBC this morning, or yesterday morning in Houston, Perry was asked if Nicolas Maduro, or when Maduro is absent, what would happen. If the American companies would return to Venezuela under a new regime. And he responded, absolutely, I think that's the real message that American companies want to see this regime outside, that we can go back, do the humanitarian assistance, do the medicines he required, he replied. And if that gave you an ironic smile, then I guess you know that he is, of course, lying about anything humanitarian. But continuing with the translation, he added that, quote, the Americans are ready to help. American companies are ready to go there. Once Maduro is out, the Americans will be first in line to give those people the kind of assistance they need and deserve, end quote. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, interviewed at the same time as his colleague Perry, both participated in a Congress on Energy and Foreign Policy, reiterated the message of the Donald Trump government that, quote, the Cuban regime has imposed its economic model on the Venezuelan people, and one can see the massive humanitarian catastrophe that is only getting worse. Energy systems that do not work, electrical networks, the socialist model, state control is simply a failed model that is causing great discomfort to the Venezuelan people, end quote. Now, of course, there have been oil tankers sitting in the harbor outside Caracas, full of oil because it cannot be sold. The Bank of England has effectively confiscated Venezuela's gold and will not allow them to sell their gold. So they can't sell oil and they can't sell gold, and it's not like they're a major industrial country because, well, the U.S. oil companies got in there and took over the economy decades ago. So they don't have money coming in, and it's very handy now to say that that's because they're socialists. But that is simply a lie. They don't have money because they are prevented from having money. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. I'll go to the next caller. David's on the air.
Oh, hi, Teresa.
Hi.
You know, I'm glad you described it in that way. I'd been trying to figure a way to get the point across to right-wingers. I'm down in San Francisco, and I call over 1,000 calls a year, you know, and I try to talk to these right-wing shows and, you know, convince them they're being tricked, right? It's hard to get through the corporate stuff. But, you know, an odd fact I learned about Venezuela, and this ties to where you were just talking about, they have assets. Venezuela has, like, the third biggest pot of oil in the world, and there is no reason for them to be broke.
Yeah, it depends on how you calculate it. If you look at the greater amount, in other words, the amount of oil that could be fracked or that can be gotten at by expensive measures, then they have the greatest oil reserves in the world, or the third, if you just want to look at what they can easily get out.
Right, and, these Koch brothers and these crazy right-wingers keep claiming, you know, they're being taxed to death. But if it requires a certain amount of infrastructure for Venezuela to come up with, pipeline access, make sure it's clean, that they don't poison their whole rivers by all of this, oil drilling, that you're going to make bridges that'll live up to their trucks. Taxes go to pay for the infrastructure for them. And for the right wing, or for the, they're just totally, they're more like organized crime now, because they don't have any common sense about having structurally sound bridges for heavy trucks. And for them to pretend that they shouldn't pay taxes, and then that it's unjust for them to pay taxes. They're tricking themselves into a whole, you know, it's killing the goose that laid the golden eggs.
Oh, hell hath no fury like a billionaire who anticipates that 1,000th part of his future imagined income has been crimped.
You know, it's funny, I keep mentioning, they all talk about like they love their country, and taxation with representation means that we pay taxes and we deserve to have a representative. Now, the right wing, or these crazy organized crime thugs, are basically claiming that they don't need to pay taxes, yet they still want to run our lives. So,
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to right wingers about it. I would, if you will allow me, I would throw a bit of advice. Right wingers don't care what the facts are, they care what side you are on. So the way to start is to talk about you being on their side and on the side of family and on the side of honor and what is right and what is good for them and what will work out best for them and keep it in that frame.
Yeah, there's a lot of good suggestions there.
And then you know, you can, even that within that frame, you can point out that they're, you know, being used. And they don't like that either. They don't like being smirked.
Well,
at and
they're,
mocked.
They're I just got on, I don't know if you know who Moon Griffon is, but he's like a network guy in the South. And he's supposed to be, he has all the words of wisdom for all of them. And I just got on with him, you know, 20 minutes ago and laid out that the South has hated New York con artists for a century and a half. New York con artists ruined the South. They ended up looting the South. And it's been a tradition, hate the New York con artist. So I got on and I said, how come you guys love a New York con artist? And, you know, he was stupefied, Benny.
Yeah, I'd say that's enough, a pretty good response because, yeah, conservatives really resent that. I mean, the fact is, what makes you conservative, really? If you're fearful enough to stunt your own, the extent of your own thinking, then you're a conservative.
Well, it's actually worse than that, because you remember, you've been in radio for over 20 years?
30.
Oh, good.
I'm not getting older or anything.
Well, you remember,
I'm doing just fine.
You remember, before Bill Clinton, it was against the law for any company to own more than three radio stations nationwide. And then under Bill Clinton, it got bumped to 8. Under Bush, it got bumped to the sky's the limit. And that's when you ended up with Clear Channel and Salem Broadcasting. And
Ben Bagdikian tried to warn us about it the whole time. And these things have consequences, you know. This Reagan revolution... We said at the time, this is going to create a fascistic society, and look at us now.
Yeah, Clear Channel, I calculated, because they had basically 2,000 stations. They owned 1,200, and they managed 800 more. And I calculate that they fired over 100,000 voices. You know, you think of 2,000 stations with a minimum of staff of 20, you know, you're coming into some solid numbers, much less a big station that might have a staff of 50 or 150. And everybody's in the radio stations trying to get their wisdom on the air. So even the janitors you can declare as voices. You know, this front secretary tries to get her joke on the air. So the idea that 100,000 people have been silenced by just jamming us with Rush Limbaugh and, you know, Hannity and Savage. Can you imagine their morning talk shows are just sneering bastards. They just sneer at you. And it's like, what a way to... You don't want to put your alarm clock on a morning sneer. And it's really interesting how their propaganda has, like, turned the country.
Well, and it has personally psychologically toxic effects, too. We are getting a little off the topic, I guess, although
Venezuela,
I appreciate everything that you've been saying about that.
Well, Venezuela, just a quick one. You know, Paul Manafort and Roger Stone were managers of dictators. And so the techniques of how they got, you know, 6 countries into dictatorships and tried to do 7 more coups... the propaganda tricks that are going on right now with Venezuela, they're adept at them. Paul Manafort is dodging crimes probably by taking part in the attack on Venezuela. That's why he got such a light sentence the other day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a war with all these little countries will just be so handy for Mr. Trump. I'm going to go to other callers, and I've got some more information from Venezuela just now, so I'll lay that on you. And I really appreciate you calling in. Thanks for your information. I want to tell Fearless Engineer Clementine that I just got an email from Caracas, and it says, "Dear Teresa, I apologize, but I never received a call from you, and I am unable to call you from my Venezuelan number. Been having internet issues, so just seeing this." And so I responded, "I understand. We will keep trying." So I figure if we can just get 5 minutes from Venezuela, heck, that's 5 minutes from Venezuela. So, and actually, you can find Lucas Kerner, the person I'm trying to talk to, on RT.com, Russia Today. I know, we all hate Russia Today because Russians, right? But, and actually, I didn't, I thought it was a pretty lame interview. I would, you know, I'm not afraid of the Russians, but that wasn't the greatest interview I've ever seen. But it, you know, it has some solid information in it. And, It's 5 minutes of Lucas Kerner, so if you're curious about that, you can find it on RT.com. So I was I've been trying to debunk the propaganda that has the American people thinking that Venezuela is a failed socialist state. Venezuela certainly has its failures, but it has whatever policies it has, we're doing just fine before the U.S. attacked. They were actually making considerable progress on poverty in the country, on actually distributing food, electrification, all kinds of things. Health is moving forward, and a couple of things happened. The price of oil collapsed, and Venezuela's oil is not like Texas sweet crude. It has to be heavily refined, and it doesn't. You don't get a profit if the price of oil goes too far down. I can't remember what the line is. It used to be $40 or something like that. It was just needed to be $50 a barrel or something like that. I don't know what it is now, but that was bad enough. But now the U.S. is absolutely preventing that oil from going out. And as I said, there are full tankers crowding the port in Venezuela. Venezuela is making phone calls around the world trying to sell their oil, and anyone who agrees to is immediately gets a call from CIA-linked, State Department-linked operatives who then tell them just how bad things are going to go for that company and people in that country if they buy that oil. Same with the gold. They literally have tons. You imagine how much money it is. How much money is a ton of gold? They have multiple tons of gold sitting in the Bank of England. Bank of England has decided that they are going to break their centuries-long tradition of being absolutely upright and reliable for the sake of their buddies in Washington. And so they will not give Venezuela their own gold. So that gold was being sold in large part to Turkey, and that was bringing in food. Well, that's not there anymore. And as Marco Rubio gloats, they are going to cause suffering unlike anything that has been seen in this hemisphere. And that's just how ugly it is. And when you look at it, when you look at the whole picture, then you'll understand that what I'm saying is, you know, make the Venn diagram. This is well within the truth. Just about everything you hear about Venezuela is a lie. Okay, number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, from Jorge Martin, writing for Marxist.com, "The failure of the 23rd of February humanitarian aid provocation on the Venezuelan border was a serious blow for Trump's ongoing coup attempt. There were mutual recriminations between self-appointed Guaido, Colombian President Duque, and U.S. Vice President Pence. The U.S. could not get a consensus from its own Lima cartel allies in favor of military intervention." Speaking for myself, when you hear that there's 50 countries supporting Guaido, remember, this is just another coalition of the willing thing. There's, you know, hundreds of countries that will not sign on. And the reason they do it this way is because they couldn't get it through their ordinary channels. Returning to Jorge Martin's article, the coup was losing momentum. Then on 7th of March, just days after Guaido's anticlimactic turn to Caracas, the country was plunged into a nationwide blackout from which it has not fully recovered. What caused it? How is it related to the regime change attempt? And most importantly, what are imperialism's plans? And how can they be fought? 23rd of February was supposed to be the coup's D-Day. The idea was never to actually deliver the humanitarian aid into the country, but rather to create a people's power movement where large crowds of opposition supporters on both sides of the border to fight the Venezuelan armed forces, which, when faced with a large crowd of peaceful demonstrators, would then switch sides and join Trump's puppet Juan Guaido. Now, I'm glad to say that we have actually gotten through to Venezuela, and if luck is with us, then Lucas Kerner is on the phone. Is that the case? Hello, Lucas. Can you hear me?
It is indeed.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
Yes, I can hear you loud and clear.
Well, thank you for your patience in getting through to KBOO Portland. What's the latest on conditions in Caracas and the rest of Venezuela?
Well, currently we have both water and electricity together, running water for the first time in a week. So we're basically millionaires. We've won the lottery today. As of last Thursday, there was a power outage, a massive power outage throughout the country, and which basically took the whole grid down. Power was subsequently restored on Friday morning, Saturday morning. And then subsequently, we lost it again, and we returned power on Sunday. And I think, at least in Caracas, the situation is largely stabilized. They've been able to get the water pump system in the southeast of the city working again. So water is now entering Caracas. Most of the city is now, you know, finally has water after, you know, nearly a week without access. In other parts of the country, the situation remains much more precarious. With, you know, just on Monday evening, you saw in the western states, Mérida and Zulia going back online after 90 hours without electricity. In other parts of the country, likewise, there's been issues with connectivity to power and water. But it seems like, at least for now, the worst is behind us, and things are starting to stabilize on a national level.
90 hours without power, but you say power's on in Caracas. Well, that's quite an accomplishment, and the water is on in Caracas, and that's what, about 5 million people?
A little bit more, yes.
Okay, so if you're listening right now, I've got Lucas Kerner on the phone. He is originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's been living in Caracas, Venezuela since January 2015. I'm getting this from the website, when he joined the Venezuela Analysis team as staff writer and editor. And so we've been trying for the entire hour to get through to Caracas and hear what Lucas has to say. And I've got questions, and you will hear the response on Lucas' end is going to be pretty garbled. There's nothing we can do about that at this point, so you might just want to turn your radio up. So, Lucas, thanks again for making the effort. How large and how well organized is the anti-Maduro, anti-socialist opposition at this point?
I think it's important to understand that the popularity of the Venezuelan government has declined precipitously with the course of this economic crisis, and the majority of the population definitely is very fed up with the government and, you know, the depth of the crisis, you know, and the inability of the government for a lot of reasons to be able to address that in a number of ways. However, I think it's important to recognize that while Maduro himself is unpopular, you know, any politician with hyperinflation, the depth of the problems, many of which are definitely the responsibility of the government, many of which are exacerbated or, you know, in some ways caused by other factors, including, you know, U.S. sanctions and U.S. intervention. But regardless of that, any leader in such a condition would be very unpopular. But that does not translate to the opposition of the country itself being incredibly popular. And it's important to understand that the opposition aligned data analysis poster found in October that the National Assembly, the opposition held National Assembly, of which Mr. Juan Guaido, who declared himself interim president on January 23rd, he's president of this body, it had a 70% disapproval rating. The opposition party likewise, you know, run 20% approval rating in the country. So definitely the reality is that the opposition, particularly the opposition leadership, is itself very unpopular, given that it has never really presented a program for getting out of this crisis and attempting to resolve the country's pressing social and economic problems. Rather, it's continually blown the trumpet of regime change and called for U.S. sanctions and, you know, now U.S. military intervention to resolve that, without actually presenting itself as an actor that can intervene in people's daily lives and solve problems and organize in working class communities. And for that reason, you see that this coup coup that was launched on January 23rd with the recognition of Juan Guaido as interim president by the Trump administration and a number of its allies, and this, you know, formation of a new coalition of the willing, you know, but even more farcical than its 2003 predecessor, that you see that they're losing momentum, and there's less and less enthusiasm on the street for Juan Guaido and for the opposition, given that it's becoming increasingly clear that just like the other five times that they attempted to oust this government, selected government, you know, beginning in the 2002 coup, recall that Mr. Elliott Abrams gave the green light for on April 11th of 2002, in which they kidnapped Chavez and dissolved the Constitution, with many of the same opposition leaders taking part, and then subsequently, you know, three other violent episodes of attempting to oust the government, and then an oil strike as well. So we definitely see that there's a feeling of, I think, discouragement among the bases of the opposition, and, you know, a passivity that this is not playing out as it was supposed to, and as it continues to drag on, the prospect of really being able to oust the government gets slimmer and slimmer.
Thank you. That's Lucas Kerner calling in from Caracas, Venezuela. Tell me, what is being used for currency in Venezuela right now? How do you go and buy lunch?
Well, I can say that the Bolivar, Venezuela's currency, is what is largely used. But Venezuela, with the massive devaluation of the currency, with the economic crisis, it has obviously multifaceted. It has a lot of different causes. But with this hyperinflationary situation, the economy has become progressively dollarized. Prices have largely been raised to international levels for a lot of key products, while wages, of course, remain very, very low. But with this blackout that we saw most recently on Thursday last week, and continuing into the parts of this week, that I've never seen so many dollars used on the street. People here, just because all of the electronic payment systems collapsed with the power outage, people have no choice but to use bolivars and in cash, which are kind of hard to come by, or just using dollars. But I think that with restoration of payment systems, obviously things are going back to normal somewhat there. But nonetheless, with the hyperinflationary situation, the dollarization has become a de facto reality in the country.
What part of Caracas are you in, and what is it like on the streets?
I live in the Santa Teresa Parish in central west Caracas, a little bit south of all the major government institutions, the Plaza Bolivar, the center of the city. It's kind of a lower middle class neighborhood that has actually changed very interestingly over the years, because the government has built a lot of public housing missions there. And as such, there's definitely a stronger Chavista presence within the neighborhood, and that's reflected in the fact that we didn't see in some parts of Caracas there were some cases of some looting, there were some isolated cases of violence, but around here largely things were very calm even during the blackout, in a way that surprised me, because I think that if you can imagine many U.S. cities losing power for 48, 72 hours, you would see massive looting, you would see significant unrest. And certainly in Maracaibo in the west, that definitely occurred. But in Caracas, things were incredibly calm. And I think that's something that, is a merit to the Venezuelan people, that, that given everything they've faced over the past years, that there's this discipline that, they're not going to allow themselves, they don't want violence, they don't want war, and they want to resolve this situation and rebuild their country.
I've been familiar over the years on how a tiny amount of violence can be focused on and broadcast to make it look like an event is violent when it is only so in the margins. For example, I remember back in 1999 when the World Trade Organization was shut down by anti-capitalist crowds in Seattle, Washington, USA. There were very few incidents of violence, but it seems that the cameras were there every time. And I even remember the local sheriff actually inciting violence, bringing people to a Radio Shack and having them pop out of his car and then go break the windows, which the which the cameras then dutifully followed. And I'm guessing that and that our feeling here in the U.S. is promoted by those cameras focusing in on the violence. And so it seems from what you're saying that it's not a case of the entire town rioting or not another Caracazo.
No, not at all. I mean, the media images that you have been receiving in the U.S. is this post-apocalyptic Mad Max situation where just, you know, everything is collapsing and people are just, you know, killing each other, you know, eating zoo animals, all of that, and that is not the case. And there are chronic problems of access to basic public services like water and electricity that have been ongoing for many years, and the government has a lot of responsibility for lack of investment, for mismanagement, for corruption, etc. So you definitely have, you know, a role of sanctions that have really played a devastating impact there. But at the same time, and you know, of course, definitely people are not able to accessing food. Likewise, you know, it's difficult that people are eating. There's not starvation in Venezuela. There is hunger like there is in any other, you know, country in the global south, and many countries of this region, actually less, I would say, in many cases in Colombia and Brazil. But given that the government has a food distribution program that, you know, is house to house, that effectively, you know, every monthly, you know, provides people with, you know, kilos of rice and beans and lentils, corn flour, et cetera, that is really a vital lifeline. 6 million families in the country receiving that benefit, you know, regardless of, you know, political affiliation or, you know, nationality. I have received this benefit. So I think that it's important to recognize that things are not as they are being portrayed, you know, in the international media. Though the situation is definitely very, very difficult and very critical in many ways, and particularly on the issue of, and with the U.S. oil embargo that was imposed on January 29th and is going to cause Venezuela's economy to contract by 26% in 2019, this is very serious. The United States has a very significant responsibility in, you know, massively increasing the suffering of the Venezuelan people, as, you know, the likes of Marco Rubio and Mike Pompeo have been gleefully tweeting about in ways that really should shock us on an ethical level.
Okay, well, Lucas Kerner, I've gotten to the top of the hour. Lucas Kerner has been living in Caracas, Venezuela since January 2015, and he is with the Venezuela Analysis Team as a staff editor and writer. Lucas, thank you very much for your efforts, for calling in and giving us that information.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
All right, you've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I just want to say in closing that there's also a false Marco Rubio report of 80 babies dying at a Venezuelan hospital. The truth is, no babies died, and I encourage you to look up the Nayira testimony. That's N-A-Y-I-R-A-H. The Nayira testimony, a false testimony given before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus on October 10th, 1990. It was an effort to promote the war with Iraq. And Ms. Nayira, who was only 15 at the time, turned out to be the daughter of the ambassador, and her testimony of babies being snatched out of incubators by Iraqi soldiers was entirely made up and intended to get you to go to war. So that's the sort of thing you can expect about Venezuela from the mainstream media, which fully covered that and put that idea in people's minds, which is very hard to dislodge. Now, stay tuned, because coming up at 10 o'clock, the Heather McCoy Show. Heather interviews LA Times sports writer Kevin Baxter, who will discuss the United States women's national team's lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation seeking equal pay. At 11, Bookwaves, 11:30, Words and Pictures with guest Dennis Kitchen. All this KBOO programming made possible by member support. We're going out to you via 90.7 other frequencies on the FM band in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO is looking for a grant writer to join our team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. Previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a one-year contract position for a total of $200,000.